Okay, and welcome to episode number 16 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob Galuzzo. I am sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
We're back.
We're back.
And we are deeper than ever.
Deeper where?
In the end.
In the deep end?
Of horror.
Deep end of horror.
We're in the deepest end of horror.
The deepest end.
I listened to that.
I passed Wiederhorn on the way here.
No, you didn't.
Does he live in LA?
I think he's retired in Florida.
Oh, okay.
We'll find him one day. Yeah. Also with us is Rebecca McKendry.
What up, guys?
Editor-in-chief of Blumhouse.com and our head of development at the Blumhouse production side of things.
Hi.
Ryan Turek.
Hello.
Welcome, man.
Thanks for having me
and
back.
Just, you know, I'm very excited because I think it was a couple days ago, Waxworks Records, one of their subscription
titles,
their records they're putting out is the soundtrack to Shockwaves.
Yes. Oh, boom.
So, boom, I got all excited. I was like,
maybe we'll get a whole bunch free. We'll start signing it.
Yeah, we'll sign those at conventions.
No copyright infringement.
We will, yes, we will sign those soundtracks.
Before we jump into our things, it was the master, Dario Argento's 76th birthday.
Right? Happy birthday, Mr. Argento.
And I was looking at that run of films he had from Deep Red to basically opera, and it's so freaking strong. It's probably second to Only Carpenter in terms of a run of films. I just wanted to ask quickly, to jump off the bat, your favorite, not best, because I always think, oh, Tenebrae is the best, but it's not my favorite. What do you think? What's your favorite Argento? Just to get the ball.
You know, it changes all the time, because we did this in the first episode.
Yeah.
Well, not with Ryan.
But not with Ryan. Yeah, what's your favorite Argento?
Tenebrae, followed by Suspiria, followed by opera.
Okay. Ooh, good one. Last time I think I said Deep Red. I think I'm still Deep Red.
Mm.
And then it would be Tenebrae. And I really love Phenomena, just because it's such a crazy, weird movie, and Donald Pleasance. So there's a mind.
That is a pretty fun. Yeah,
Suspiria, by far.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know, Sleepless or The Card Player.
Well, I'm going to go home and watch Dracula 3D.
I got to be honest, I don't hate The Card Player.
No, look, they're all shot well. They're just not. They've lost something.
Yeah.
I think I'm
like
still
Hitchcock?
Suspiria.
I like Stendhal.
Yeah, Stendhal's actually got some really interesting stuff. I'm going to go Suspiria, but you know what? Inferno is really
bonkers.
Because it's pure cinema. The purest of all his films. It's the movie that here, like, there's no narrative.
Well,
there's no character. It's
a good
just
chunk
stuff
of which he didn't really direct, though.
Oh, well.
Which is revealed on the Blu-ray that I worked on.
Well, Mario Bava did the last
one. Lamberto Bava did all the underground water stuff with Irene Miracle because Daria just stopped talking to her. you know what? If you don't have the Blue Underground release, there's some fun stuff on there.
Yeah. And that was the one where he was shooting something at the same time as Lustig, right? And they would meet up in a park. There's some story they're all hanging out.
Who, Argento?
It might have been that one,
It always warms my heart when I hear stories about Argento kind of bleeding into American cinema, with the filmmakers, you know, when he paired up with, like, Romero and Dawn of the Dead and stuff.
Yeah,
it just warmed my heart that there was an era in which, you know.
He was respected by other peers who were making horror films. Yeah. They were like, and to think he wrote Once Upon a Time in the West. Yeah. That's pretty fucking
cool. It's kind of like when Takeshi Miike was embraced.
Yeah. Takeshi. I'm going to be talking about him in a minute.
And not to get too far off track, but since you brought up Argento, I know there's he just did a 4K restoration of Dawn of the Dead or Zombie, his version.
Yeah. Oh.
That's premiering. Where is it premiering, Ryan? Do you know?
Venice?
Venice, I think. Yes. Now, here's the thing. The rights to the U.S. and overseas are completely different.
Yeah.
So just because there's a 4K restoration the European cut Zombie doesn't mean we're going to get it here. Yeah. I don't know.
You could get an import of that, right?
I don't know. There's no release. There's just the screening. Huh. There's no release info and details. Last I heard, what's his name? Richard.
The guy's Martin and everything.
Rothenstein.
Rothenstein.
Yeah, he was doing a 3D conversion of Dawn of the Dead.
Which has been going on for
years.
Last 10 years. Yeah.
So who knows? But maybe we'll get to see a proper 4K restoration of Dawn of the Dead. I mean, right now it's just the European cut. So we'll see what
happens. Here's the Dario. And don't forget about these guys. Just if you don't like their last movies, don't forget the amazing work they gave you in the middle of their career.
I agree with that.
That's incredible stuff.
That might even come back later.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Becca, what did you see this week?
I'll start with one that Elric needs to see because he will like this. From 1980, I saw Harlequin.
I've heard of it.
And this was released recently on Blu-ray by Scorpion Releasing. And it is pretty much like a Rasputin story about this guy there's this senator and his son has cancer or leukemia or something like that. And this weird guy shows up and claims to be a faith healer, but he kind of takes control of the family. It's weird. It's like totally weird. And the character, the main character, the faith healer, was originally written for David Bowie. And not played by David Bowie in the film. But yeah, you will like it, Ulrich.
Is it by one of the guys of The Who in it?
I don't
know. Curly
hair?
The main guy?
I don't remember
In my
that.
Brain, it feels like that.
I don't think Roger Daltrey is in it. I would have noticed that.
He's in a few
movies. But yeah, so you will like that one.
Last time she said that, it was like a guy riding around a bike. It was the part of an episode that we lost. Remember that one? And I said, what do you think, I'm Chris Alexander? And that joke never saw the light of day.
Until now.
It's the same director as Snapshot, or The Day After Halloween. It's an Australian film. I swear we've had a conversation about this film before. Never mind. And then the other one that I saw, which doesn't seem like horror, but it becomes horror in the movie, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which Criterion just put out this absolutely gorgeous Blu-ray of. The movie is just batshit. And I mean, it's exactly what you think it is. It's a massive Hollywood movie that they hire Russ Meyer, the king of exploitation, to do the sequel for. Mm-hmm. And so
Who co-wrote it? Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert, yep. Thank you.
And he apparently wore a diaper a lot of the time, liked to be spanked.
Like you.
Some of the stories. Oh,
yeah. So copious amounts of drugs and weirdness and sex and free love and rock and roll. The movie's awesome. And then in the last third, it becomes kind of a horror movie, which is really cool.
A lot of his films had all sorts of crazy weird genre twists. Yeah. Them, you know? You think about Faster Pussycat.
Yeah.
A lot of big twists.
No, yeah, and Mondo Topless. I mean, it was like total twist.
Actually, Becca, a personal request, because I'm not getting off this kind of idea right now. Roger Daltrey in horror films. Can you please do a Blumhouse.com top 10? Because I can't get out of my mind that Roger Daltrey was in Vampirella.
Oh, that's right.
That is right.
And I saw another trailer recently.
Completely tangential conversation.
Oh, was he in that one with the cat and the guy with the mustache that you loved? He was your spirit animal at one point? You remember
my spirit animal?
Yeah. Sorry about one time you posted Sam Elliott. What's that, Sam? The Legacy. I think Roger Daltrey's in that.
Oh, yeah.
I think Daltrey's in one scene of that.
Yeah. He totally is.
All right. So, guys, we're going to need a Roger Daltrey retrospective.
Yeah. All right. In the works. In the works. What about you, Ryan? You see anything this week?
I kicked back and watched The Mummy, the
original.
Old Universal. Yeah, the original Mummy. I spent the weekend kind of just – I was in New York. So I saw a viewing of Morgan, which it is what it is. Yeah. You know,
I'll only ask you this. Is there more than what the trailer shows? Like, are there any other hints or surprises?
Yes. And you guess it in the first minute of the movie.
Oh, okay.
I love the kind of concept of AI and turning a horror spin on it. But honestly, It didn't register with me, I was kind of bummed out.
Didn't look at Sexiest Species.
Huh?
Not a Sexiest Species, you know?
Sexiest Species, correct. I rewatched The Mummy. I kind of got in the Halloween spirit of things on Labor Day weekend. And
are you a fan of that original Mummy?
Well, this is funny because I think on the Bloodcast, and David Scow kind of sides with me on this, I believe, but the original Mummy does not work.
I agree.
It is a very laborious film.
Oh, the original, yeah. It's shot really well, and he looks great. But
there's some of the makeup. The first, once you get beyond the first 5 minutes, the first 5 minutes, you know, when he's actually resurrected, he grabs the manuscript, and he kind of walks off, and you know, the guy loses his mind. After that, it's all kind of downhill. And I thought this time, watching it, just because my girlfriend and I are kind of going through all the Universal classic movie monsters over from between now and Halloween. And, I thought I would like being completely attentive to the cinema of it, being completely attentive to the storytelling of it. And I'm like, no, there's a certain malaise to it, you know, I'm just like,
and what's crazy about that is I think it's like 76 minutes and
it feels like 95 minutes, but it's really a really short movie. And I think it's just because there's not a whole lot of meat on its bones, you know. It's a movie about a curse, you know, a mummy who comes back. They cut to 10 years later, and it's Boris Karloff kind of doing his thing and guiding these scientists onto another kind of gravesite and then trying to resurrect his girlfriend. And it's like, dude, that's it. There's no more substance to it. And it kind of – when you look back at the Universal Classic movie monsters, I I respect Dracula and I respect mm-hmm. the Mummy, but they're not my favorites.
Yeah, I
agree with that 100%.
And even as films, you know mm-hmm. what Todd Browning did with Dracula. Again, there's a rhythm to it that is not my speed.
And
you
the
know?
Spanish one's better, and they're filmed on the same sets. The Spanish one moves a little better.
Yeah. I've only started on the Mummy. I love all the classic movie monsters. Yeah. It's what it's the kind of food that I was raised on growing up as a horror fan. But I still stand by it. Like this, like fifth version, you know, viewing of the Mummy that I've given it, and I'm like, no, I'm out. I can't do it. And if I remember, they get really schlocky from here on out. I don't remember.
See, but that's what I remember. It, like my interpretation of the Mummy or memory of it is actually the sequels. You know, the guy in the bandages that's running around like, you don't really get that version of it because it's Karloff in the first one.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Of those classics, you're totally right because I try to revisit them almost every year. Mm-hmm. One year I just went sequel. I was like, you know what?
Oh, because really? Yeah.
What I love about the Universal Monster sequels, and it's worth saying because I think it's next Tuesday. I think it's the 13th. I already pre-ordered them. They're doing Blu-ray box sets of Frankenstein. It's next week. Frankenstein and Wolfman are the first two.
Jesus.
And it's cool, but there's a problem with it. Whereas the DVDs were the legacy collections. Mm-hmm. Each one had about five films each.
Mm-hmm.
And if you bought them all, you can consecutively go. Right now, they're only doing Frankenstein and the Wolfman. And it includes all the Frankenstein movies and all the Wolfman movies.
Right.
But there's crossover. So, like, they both have Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Right, right. That big box set that came out, that Universal put out.
But they didn't cross over.
They did. I looked at it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did cross over because I was looking at the Wolfman, and I was like, oh, Frankenstein meets Wolfman's on here. Then I looked at the Frankenstein collection. Frankenstein meets Wolfman's here.
So they're doing that where there's a lot of bleed over. But, I got to give it up for Universal because, again, a few years ago I went through the sequels. And what I loved about it, and you could go on the Wikipedia or whatever – is they literally, you could watch them all consecutively. Yeah. Like, they literally picked up wherever, you know, they're like, they fell off a cliff fighting the next movie, whatever it is, like House of Dracula, whatever, is, you know, oh, somebody finds their frozen bodies. Uh-huh.
Well, Frankenstein was, like, exhumed, and he's, like, still covered in the kind of clay that he fell into. You know?
Yeah,
like,
so props to continuity.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's, like, the funny thing that cracks me up is that, you know, fans now will go, oh my God, shared universe, classic movie monsters.
They already did it, yeah.
Yo, they did that. Yeah, they did that. Like, they legit House of Dracula, you know, House
Brought
of Frankenstein.
Them all together, yeah.
Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, you know. Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, you know.
What's Tom Cruise doing now? It's something.
He's doing The Mummy.
And we don't really know what it's going to be, though.
So the girl, it's a kind of contemporary story, like set in the Middle East.
Okay.
And the one
action like the last version?
I don't know. Mm. I don't know, but I heard it's really scary. Like they're actually going for scares.
Good.
The Mummy is played by a woman Sophia something. Oh, she was in Kingsman. She was the girl with the
razor legs.
With the razor legs. And she plays the Mummy.
I think she's in Star Trek Beyond. She's the woman with all the makeup.
Star Trek Beyond. Yeah. She's a great actress.
And now will that be part of the universe that they're trying to rebuild?
The Dracula Untold is not part of the universe.
Right. Yeah. I knew that. Yeah.
It begins with the Mummy.
Why not?
Okay. So I wonder who gets Creature because, I mean, that's still been the coveted prize for so many filmmakers. How many have done it? Joe Dante had the big...
Del Toro with Scowl.
I wonder who was the closest. Maybe Dante, because I knew they had actually shot stuff.
I think Eisner.
Oh, Breck Eisner, yeah.
He's the most recent.
Eisner was the most recent and pretty close.
It's like I would look at Guillermo and think that's a no-brainer.
Right.
I think Guillermo could deliver something special there.
Yeah. But you never know. So anyway.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Anything else? Mummy?
That was it. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm going to dive into a bunch of stuff this weekend. I want to kind of catch up on a classic. Because it's like now... Like once September is kind of rolled in, it's like, okay. I usually use September and October to kind of revisit the classics, whether it's Universal Classic Movie Monsters or the Hammer titles or, I mean, like every, I always say this, it's like, guys, horror movies were like long before 1970, you know? I hear a lot of people say 1980, but, you know, 1970 is usually the kind of like watermark, and it's like, no, there's a lot of great stuff before that.
Yeah, for sure. All right, what about you, Elric?
Well, I'll talk about one film that I doubt anyone here will disagree on, The Glory of the new Rob Zombie film, 31, because I'm pretty sure we'll all be uniform on that.
Because I saw it.
I saw it, yeah. And I know
we have a lot to talk about.
I know Ryan's seen it.
I saw this on Dan, too.
Yeah, so everyone's going to be on the same page here. I imagine we all just thought it was great.
Except our social media guy who's sitting next to me. Maybe he agrees. I don't know.
John, I'm in your corner, baby. I'll tell you what.
No, you're not.
Here, look.
We're going to come to blows right now.
Here's my thing.
Wait. What?
Here's my thing.
What's your thing?
Turek saw my tweet, and he wrote to me straight away.
What was your tweet? Because I don't pay attention to these things.
Yeah, I know. You know. My tweet was just, look, there's a lot of mess here, but Richard Brake is so great
in
the role of Doomhead. His moments, I'll go further. I swear to God they're shot differently, because I think the camera still, anytime he's on film and it's actually shot cinematically, everything else is so messy. All the action scenes are unbearable. The action scenes are the worst thing about the movie. So don't get me wrong. I'm not a lover, but what I will say is I was sitting there. I don't know if Dick liked it as much as me, but I had kind of a smirk on my face the whole time, because I was like, you know what? As bad as parts of this is, he makes ugly films still, and no one's doing this. And he's still making that movie he loves. This one is, yes, I agree with the low-hanging fruit. No. He's making a fan film a little bit. No. The worst thing I'll say about it is it feels like it's his first film. And that's a problem when you're on your fifth film. This could have been a rookie first film, you know? But Doomhead is one of my favorite things of the year. I'm not even lying. Like, that character. Okay. That character. Okay, let me put this out. There's a final scene in this movie, which I thought was fucking rad.
All right. I'm waiting for you to finish. You done yet?
That's it.
All right. That's great. That's it. You know what? I love Rob as a personality. I like him as a musician. I love him in interviews. Like, he's such a smart, articulate guy, and I love hearing him talk about everything from movies to music to whatever. However, this is six movies in now. As I left this one, I just have to come to terms with the fact that Rob Zombie movies are not for me. And this is after...
You didn't like Lords of Salem, right?
I didn't like Lords of Salem at all. I tried to watch it again last year. What's that?
You like Rejects.
Rejects I like.
You talked about Rejects.
Yeah. I talked about House and Rejects last week, and I kind of like them, but even this movie made me second guess if I like them. Like, that's how...
Wow.
You know, but like you said, he makes mean movies, and this one to me felt like it belongs... It feels like a second movie. It feels like what he would have made in between House and Rejects.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like kind of early on. And I think the opening scene is fantastic, which is with that actor you just mentioned, Richard Brake. Like, the opening is...
He's a Game of Thrones guy, which I didn't realize at the time.
And he was also in Halloween,
He's in Halloween, too, and he says the F word 800 times. Yeah.
I felt like I'd never seen him before. That was part of my excitement about it. I felt like, oh, I've never seen this actor, and there's something about that.
First time I ever saw him, he was in Doom.
Doomhead now.
First person.
Doomhead. Oh,
but you know what? What really, I don't know if it bothers me or I agree with it, but like, obviously I saw it as part of this fandom event, and he did a Q&A at the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, everything is cute. Like, at whatever mixed feelings you have, he confirms in his Q&A. The first thing is, they're like, how did you come up with the movie? He's like, well, I was working on this other movie, and it was taking so long. I was on a phone call, and I was like, you know what? I bet I could fucking make something up right now on the spot, and I'll get that made before this. So that's how I came up with this movie.
Yeah, 4 minutes.
And you're like, oh, my God. He's like, literally, I just threw this shit out of my head, and I was like, I bet I could get that made.
The thing that bothers me about that, however, is that he used fandom money.
He
crowdfunded the money, the movie, to get it made, you know, and it's like,
don't you think it's going to hit those fans that are going to like it?
Absolutely. Well, that's the demo, you know, but when you're so dismissive, like in that kind of creative space, it's like, dude, come on now. Now, listen, I mean, like my whole viewpoint with Rob, I mean, like I still listen to his music. I'm a fan. Sometimes I side with his views, sometimes I don't. You know, my favorite movie of his is still Devil's Rejects.
Yep.
You know, House of a Thousand Corpses is a great, I thought it was a great first. You know, it was funny, I was just listening to the last week's episode, Rob, before, and I completely agree with you in terms of when House of a Thousand Corpses came onto the scene. I think the reason why people responded to it the way they did, I mean, this was like 2003, is because we were in the midst of like the kind of J-horror remake kind of thing, and all of a sudden, someone came along and made a movie that confirmed for horror fans that horror that we grew up on wasn't dying. Like that we were seeing that kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre-like ferocity and a kind of like throw everything out the window, who gives a fuck kind of violence.
Yeah.
And nobody was making that kind of movie, you know? So that's what we all kind of responded to. And it was kind of like it was a mixtape movie.
Well, I mean, because we grew up on, we were looking for these hard to find Italian movies and convention stuff. You know, this movie got thrown out by Universal and it got delayed by 2 years. So you're like, it's too horrifying to put out. Right. So the hype, because nothing was happening horror, and you're like, what's so intense about this movie that Universal's scared to put it out?
Yeah. Well, there
so
was
that built
yeah, there
into
was,
it.
Yeah, there was that too. There was that too. But I mean, with 31, man, I went into it with an open mind and I wanted a return to form, you know?
Yeah,
I wanted that return to form. And I just feel like And, you know, these are completely my own thoughts on it. But, you know, I felt like Lords of Salem, which I appreciate and actually admire.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Is, you know, I think that kind of scared him after doing Lords of Salem. And obviously, I'm sure there's other factors about trying to get another movie made. And he's probably not thinking too deep into it. But I felt like it was kind of, okay, I'm just going to return to form in a... in a stylistic sense. You
I mean,
know?
It's the most like, Rob Zombie movie Rob Zombie's ever made, like, totally, at least totally. In terms of like...
Well, it's a music video, you know, and like, I mean, like, yeah, you get, that's a lazy critique, but it's like, it's truly kind of like the old school Rob Zombie music video. But unfortunately, there's like just nothing to hang
the character
hat
stuff
on,
up
man.
Front is its weakest part. You don't care about any of them.
I didn't.
At all.
I never felt more distant.
Yeah, like, they're not real characters.
Well, I don't understand. Like, I don't get... in any of his films, and I get that that's maybe the point, you know, because look, I go to the New Beverly all the time. Yeah. I see exploitation movies, but like, I don't think he knows the difference between an antagonist and a person. You know, like, for a while, we spend so much time with this Mexican midget Nazi character, and I'm not sure, am I supposed to be rooting for him? Because then he kills one of the main characters.
Yeah.
And the way
the
it's presented, you're like, I feel really bummed, actually. Am I supposed to, like, side?
Well, yeah, you know? I mean, like, his movies always kind of blur that
line between
hero and villain.
I guarantee some people are
going
to like it. But I will say that even if you're someone who doesn't really like it, you might be like me, where seeing that in a theater is still somehow, there's something about it that's still like, oh, it's cool. There's still crazy movies being made. And there's one thing in it that got me. There's a scene where the character's introduced, even though you've seen him up front, with Nosferatu playing, that I'm just laughing. I'm like, because I'm like, no one makes shit like this. It's so deranged and idiotic, but but the actor's so fucking good. So this guy Richard Brake to me is a complete star.
I agree with you on that.
I hope people see that part of it. You know, I can't say I love the film. I did see a film I loved, absolutely loved. It might be one of the best films I saw this year. And I was telling Dick Gruner how much I loved it, and he goes, "Oh, Rebecca loves that movie." I'm like, "I've never heard her talk about that." And he said, "Yeah, it was the episode you were sick." And I don't listen to the episodes. It is I am not a serial killer.
Oh, which, dude.
The title is terrible.
I love this
movie. That title, I was like, oh, I'm never going to watch it. I had heard nothing. When's the last time you heard nothing? And I went on VOD and I was like, you know what? I went on Letterboxd and I saw all these 5-star reviews. I was like, what? Yeah. So I didn't even read them. Push play. This movie was so fucking refreshing. I think Rob would love it.
Yeah.
Because it feels like a throwback. It feels like a 90s movie.
This is the one I described to you as Fright Night meets Dexter.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm in.
And it's the coolest thing is it's shot on 16mm film.
Yep.
And it just has a feeling. It's a mixture of that innocent 80s feeling of a story, but with actual horror moments that, you know, aren't really scary, but it's just fun. And that movie... that's probably the sleeper I've seen this year, where I haven't heard people talking about it, you know, besides hearing now that you liked it and Becca. It's different, though. You're not hearing people talk about it, and it deserves to be spoken about. And it's Christopher Lloyd. So if you want an 80s connection, Christopher Lloyd has a great role in it.
And it's from the director of a movie called Isolation. Mm. That was his name. The filmmaker is Billy Burke. He's an Irish filmmaker, I believe.
Yeah, because it looked like it might have even been shot in Ireland, but for America.
But it was. But he did this movie called Isolation, which I think came out in like 2006. And it's like a monster run amok on a farmland kind of thing. It's like a bioengineer kind of mistake, kind of playing on bioengineered food and all this other kind of stuff. I remember seeing it in Spooky Dan's backyard, and I remember going, oh man, this movie, you don't often see people who outright go, I'm going to use Alien 3 as a reference to my film, but he used it. It looked exactly like that, and that always stuck with me. And then he just kind of went off the map, and he came back with this movie, and I was like, talk about a movie like you love the kid. You love Max Records.
Yeah,
Max Records.
Yeah, he's so good. What's a coming of age film at
it? It's a coming of age film. But it's like, but the character is somebody who, the character is kind of battling his, there's a duality to him. Mm-hmm. He hasn't done anything yet that's wrong, but he's fighting it.
It's a character on the cusp and meeting something worse.
Yeah.
It's a really terrific film. Honestly, I think people will really dig it. I'm going to give you a quote if anyone can get this. I saw this movie. I don't think I've ever seen this before. I loved it. I swear to God, there's going to be a rape tonight. It's the key line in this movie cop says, I swear to God, there's going to be a rape tonight. It is Incubus, starring John Cassavetes. And it is a batshit movie. Literally, the whole story of this movie is that a demon is coming back and it's too well endowed and it is killing women. through rape, and it's killing in this New Hampshire or Massachusetts town of witches. It is from 1981. It is it was based on a book, and people say the book's terribly boring. This is one of those Canadian gems, and here's the best part. It's like one of those movies where the material is so B, but the director is the guy who made what's the classy British haunted house film?
Legend of Hell House.
And Vampire Lovers or whatever. So it has this very classy, in a sense, direction. Yeah. And then Cassavetes is just like, it's probably, I think, his last role, one of his last roles. He's kind of sleepwalking through this thing, literally wondering, why the fuck am I in this movie?
It's a weird movie.
It's a weird fucking movie, but it's one of those movies, you can't get it anywhere. It's not on DVD, it's not anything.
What?
But
it's gonna be like on...
But it's streaming on Amazon. Yeah. That's what's so great about it. So I'm watching it on Amazon. It's a really bizarre film. I really think people should watch it, but I'll tell you,
I haven't watched that movie in years.
I haven't wanted to remake a movie harder than I'm just like, oh my god, everything about this movie except the fact that it's not a great movie. Yeah. And then last thing, one liner. I watched it again last night. Hadn't seen it since it came out on video. Battle Royale. You were just talking about Katana, Takeshi Kitano. Man, it is such smart satire. It is funny, and it is so. It's the best directed film outside of like Tarantino and that.
Yeah.
Just the way it's put together. And I was just loving it. I was laughing my ass, and especially because I just started teaching again. I just could totally identify with Kitano when he looks at them, just like, fuck all of you. I'm going to kill all of you on an island, you know? So,
who can tell me about the sequel? Did anyone watch that?
I've never
Battle
seen
Royale 2?
Yeah, I
saw it. I mean, like, that was another movie that got like a weird release, and I remember watching it. It was completely insignificant. Like,
really?
It was
same director or not?
I thought it was, because when the Blu-ray came out of the first
same
one.
Same director, but I think his son picked up. Because
he was old. That's right. Yeah, the Battle Royale director.
I think
quite
he
old.
Passed away. The son picked up the reins, and then we got kind of like a patchwork movie. But I remember it not being a glaring insult to the fans of the first film, but it was just kind of like, meh.
Well, yeah, why bother? Yeah.
Now, the first one, if you haven't seen it like me for so long, it was so fun to revisit.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah,
it's
really classic, is. I agree with that. Yeah.
Cool. Well, for me, you know what? I'm almost, I only got one filmmaker to talk about, two films, and I'm almost embarrassed to say that it's taken me this long to watch this movie. Because I'm a big fan of this director, at least his early work. I'm talking about Jim Mickle. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing Mulberry Street back, I think it was one of the 8 films to die for. And, you know, Larry Fessenden's in it. He's part of that crew. So I saw it, and I was like, this movie's crazy. Like, rat zombie people? What's going on here? And then, you know, and then he bumped up a little bit with Stakeland, which I thought was a really cool movie as well. And, you know, he made a few movies since. And for whatever reason, I never got around to them. And it's like, you know, late one night, I got Netflix up. And Cold in July, based on the Joe Lansdale story. And it's like the first movie that Michael C. Hall did post-Dexter.
Yep.
And I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to watch Cold in July because I've been meaning to. And it's rare, but man, did that movie blow me away. Like, I knew nothing about it also. So I loved this movie. And, you know, the very basic premise, the way it starts out is that, you know, right in the opening, there's an intruder breaking into Michael C. Hall's house. He goes down, he hesitates, and he kills the guy. And that's kind of it. And you kind of got a little bit of the aftermath of, like, you know, how do you deal with that? And then just by fate, the father of the burglar is just getting out of jail, and he's kind of a bad dude. And, you know, he might want a little bit of payback. But what I loved about it is that, you know, you're emotionally invested in that part of the story. But the twists and turns that come from that, you would never predict from the first half hour what the last half hour is going to be.
And that last act is pure Lansdale, right?
Like, and that last act is amazing. It kind of reminded me... stylistically, the reason, like I love this movie, love it. It's on Netflix since, and I absolutely give it my strongest recommendation. You know, like all those movies in the 90s, post Pulp Fiction, kind of like the post Tarantino ripoff movies, which I still loved. Like I loved Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
There's even like a John Dahl Last Seduction,
kind of
noir quality.
Red Rock West.
Like a perfect gem from that period. Like the best post Tarantino movie you never got to see.
Oh, and Don Johnson's best role.
Oh my god!
Since anything.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's Michael C. Hall's amazing, and it's Sam Shepard. Don Johnson owns that fucking
Don
movie.
Johnson. And I've heard that character is going to get a spinoff. Something.
Well, yeah, and then I posted about it, and everybody told me like, well, are you watching Happ and Leonard? And I'm like, no, I'm not. It's like, oh, it's all the same characters, and it's Don Johnson's characters in those stories at some point.
Yeah. And Evan Katz directed some of that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
it's a good show.
Jim
Nichols. I heard all it was good.
I gotta figure out.
It's
how
not
to watch
as good
it.
As Cold in July. Cold in July is tonally more,
top
I mean?
Notch
than Happened.
Great
film. Even though it's a good show.
And then and then the next night, I'm like skimming on Netflix, and I was like, oh, I haven't seen his remake of We Are What We Are either.
Oh, yeah.
So let me do that
it's
one.
Good.
And also blown away by it. You know, I haven't seen the original, but I hear he changes a lot of the roles.
Very different. Feels like makes a very it different, a different movie. Luckily,
yeah. And that's the way you do a remake. But there was enough of his own style in it. And, you know, a few months ago, I hosted a Q&A for Fender Bender, Mark Pavia's movie. And the villain is Bill Sage, mm-hmm. who is the father mm-hmm. in this movie. So yeah, I was like, oh, man, there's that guy. And it's
if you want some older Bill Sage, just check out American Psycho.
Oh, yeah, he's in that. Yeah,
he's
one
of Patrick Bateman's cronies. Weird.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But
everyone was in that, right? Jared
Leto. Everybody. But you know what? We are another one on Netflix that I strongly recommend. And if anything, because not only is Bill Sage great in it, but you got Michael Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them, their scene together, top notch.
Yeah. It's not one of the best endings of that year.
Oh, by
far. I think
far.
The last 20 minutes of that was... Because it's a slow burn getting you somewhere, but when it pays off, it
exactly.
pays off.
Exactly. So, again, now I'm all in on anything Nickel does, quite frankly.
Well, and the best news of all, him and Joe Lansdale, apparently, like they just were like a house on fire when they did Cold in July. So... I can
and
imagine
Leonard
a lot of
is Lansdale
yeah,
stuff
exactly.
too, right?
But I can imagine Mikkel maybe being the one who finally does get Dead End Drive-In or something, you know?
Oh yeah,
the Drive-In or something up on screen, which no one's been able to do.
I hope Coscarelli
hasn't been able to do it.
He's such a unique and interesting filmmaker that not enough people in the genre are talking about. But I got to give it up for Jim Mikkel.
Cool.
And speaking of unique talents that you wouldn't expect to be a horror fan. We have a very special guest coming on in a few minutes that mm-hmm. you will know from his comedies. But if you pay attention to the show Key & Peele, or even in Keanu's got a lot of fun little horror references in it,
that's right.
Then it should not surprise you how much he loves the genre. So stick around. We're going to be talking to Jordan Peele in a few minutes. Oof. All right, welcome back to the show, and boy, are we excited, because the way that Ryan kind of told us about this whole deal was that, you know, Jordan Peele, our special guest, hi.
Hi. Hello, Jordan.
Jordan did a movie with Blumhouse,
yep.
And through that process, Ryan, you know, had a lot of conversations with him and said, he's a big horror fan.
No, and, I mean, my fondest memories, Jordan, of the last year is you coming into my office and looking wistfully around at the posters. And,
yeah, I mean, you've got a good collection of stuff.
Yeah. And I realized, you know what? There's a twinkle in his eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that little twinkle that only horror fans get when they look at Rosemary's Baby posters.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, nice.
Right.
I hung out there for probably a little bit uncomfortably long.
Yeah. I did have to say, you know, hey, Bea, you know, can you get Jordan out of here, please? I got to work.
It's not a museum. But no, very cool, cool stuff. And yeah, Rosemary's Baby, that was definitely a bond for us. And you got some Halloween stuff in there. Very cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of it comes up in your work. But that's cool is that, I doubt a lot of times when you're doing interviews for either the show or projects or movies, you get to talk about your love of horror. And that's what the show is all about. Yeah. And for us, you know, I say this every week, so apologies for being repetitive. We're of the VHS generation. Mm-hmm. We grew up with that kind of growing up. What was it for you? How did you kind of get introduced to horror? I mean, did you come from a family that was kind of movie savvy and watching stuff all the time? Or
not really. I got through into horror first through a friend of mine, very young, had the Fangoria magazines up. And, you know, I was kind of, you know, horror scared the shit out of me. Mm. And I kind of wasn't allowed to watch things. My mother knew would freak me out. But this friend was a little bit of an escape. It was a place where his mom let him, so I would, you know, go to this friend's house, you know, watch, you know, I remember at first what was the Fangorias. Like, I think I experienced Nightmare on Elm Street, for example, through those Fangorias mm-hmm. and sort of pieced together, you know, that I had somehow watched it. And, of course, that, you know, those images scared me so much. I think it was right around the time Dream Warrior came out.
Yeah. Nice.
So the third one. And, you know, so, yeah. And so very through play dates and friends, I sort of got these pieces of horror that invaded my psyche. And, you know, later on I realized it's, you know, it's all me. It's my true passion.
But there was something to there was some sort of stimuli to even just the visuals, the photographs themselves that were magnetic to you.
Yeah, and something's, you know, something about Fangoria itself, it had such a sort of disregard for, you know, it was all the goriest pictures. Yep. And I remember, you know, just seeing some picture of somebody with his guts hanging out, and it, just so extreme.
Yeah.
And so realistic.
Day of the Dead, probably.
Yeah. It could have been Day of the Dead. Yeah. I remember one of the things that Dream Warriors did affect me. Dream Warriors was a movie that was on that cusp of scary as hell, but mm-hmm. so fun.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And so it sucked me in, you know, the fun I was okay with, and I could kind of watch it. And then later when I'd go to sleep, it's like, okay, now I'm, you know, I'm thinking about the dude that became a human puppet, you know, because
it's the fantasy level, right, of the 80s. We often talk about on the show, the 80s had this really playful quality, even to the darkest horror films, which was great.
And there was something, I was going to say, there's something to Nightmare on Elm Street 3 that wound up being a beacon for all youth. Mm. Like Nightmare on Elm Street, that like attracted people. Nightmare on Elm Street 2, kind of a similar, but there was like this kind of like ping out into the universe where every kid was like, I want to know what that movie is.
I think that 3 was kind of the perfect formula for the youth because it was still scary as shit. But at the same time, Freddy became a little bit funnier. Not full comedian Freddy that we saw in later like 4 and 5.
Yeah.
But he was just witty enough to say like, it's prime time, bitch, or let's get high. Mm-hmm. So it had that. And then it also had this really sweet rock and roll edge to it. So it just, for me as a kid, Dockin it was like song. Rocking with Dockin', man. It was like the perfect formula of everything I loved at that time.
Well, that's I mean, Nightmare 3 to me is like the quintessential Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at the whole franchise, that's the one. If you only watch one of them, I think you get everything that you need out of that franchise from that one movie.
Well, and it was also younger kids, too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, they were still kind of like high schoolers, but I think I was still in middle school when that movie came out, but it was still but they were high schoolers, but they were like, you somehow identified with them a little bit easier than Nancy and Glenn.
Yeah. They've lived life, man. They've seen life. Shit.
That's right. They've been to the dark side themselves. There was also this element where most conventional horror movies, certainly the other Nightmare on Elm Street, it's like the last 20 minutes you get sort of becoming the badass to defeat the demon kind of
the
thing.
The wish fulfillment of it all.
Yeah, they started kicking ass around the midpoint or maybe even earlier.
Yeah.
And so there's something kind of empowering as a kid to watch, okay, yeah, man, there's scary shit going on, but they're badass. And what's usually reserved for the last 15 minutes of a horror movie, it was like, that was the project.
And you're only as good as the villain is bad, and because he's able to actually defeat them when they have superpowers. You know what I mean? You've really elevated Freddy's power, which is
cool.
That's right. You know?
But they weren't all cool. That was another thing that I remember about 3 is that there were dorks in it, too. Like
the Dungeons & Dragons guy.
Yeah, the Dungeons & Dragons guy.
Like the Swarm.
Yeah.
like the way we're talking about this movie.
That's right.
These are the dorks.
We were in that movie, guys.
and that was, of course, like he was the guy who the nurse, the hot nurse, mm-hmm. Freddy turned into the hot nurse. And, you know, there was like, you know, that was where my VCR got stuck every time, right?
Like, watching that scene over
a breakthrough for myself, but yeah.
What were some of the, you know, for all of us? There's always the one movie that we saw maybe a little too young, the Indelible. Oh, that movie fucked me up. So, do you remember which horror movies maybe had a little bit too much of an impact on you?
You know, it's hard to say. I think a lot of them I probably saw too young. You know. But at the same time, it's hard to say too young. I saw The Shining when I was, you know, probably too young. But it's so formative now that it wasn't.
But the test with that film is: are you older or younger than Danny?
That's right.
Younger is fucked up.
That's a good point.
Older, you're safe.
You know, a lot of the Stephen King adaptations freaked me out. I mean, certainly. But, you know, there's moments in many different movies that just got to me. Zelda from Pet Sematary.
Oh, my
right?
God, yeah.
One of the scariest things of all time.
I'm still not too sure what spinal meningitis.
Spinal bifida, yeah.
Right.
I don't know. It was some messed up stuff.
It was messed up stuff.
You don't forget that moment.
That moment when they're coming up the stairs and she, you know, she pops up into action in the bed.
And it was a man. I only found that out like last year.
And it was
year.
A man.
All these years, I was like, oh, my God.
That's right. At one point, this is awful, but at one point I was talking to Keegan about Pet Sematary, Keegan-Michael Key from Key and Peele, and he goes, "Oh, Jordan, let me tell you, I watched that movie with my, you know, with my cousin or something. What's her name from Pulp Fiction and Honey Bunny? The
Amanda Plummer
freaked me out in that movie. Like, Amanda Plummer, I'm pretty sure she's not in. He says she's in it. She was Zelda. She was Zelda. Looked it up. It was a man. I was like, oh, Keegan.
That's a good association though.
Good association. It is close.
But, and that's a sick burn on our listener Amanda Plummer,
who is a wonderful actor. And, that freaked me out. Jaws 2. Yeah. I saw, you know, that one.
It's a mean-spirited movie. You know,
right? Yeah, I mean, it turned it into much more of a stalker film.
He's
right?
A slasher. Yeah, the shark is a slasher. Yeah,
right. And one by one, picking apart the teens that are having sex and whatnot. So yeah. that one got in early. Critters.
Oh yeah, love Critters.
Nice.
Love it. And you know, at the same time, haunted me.
Yep.
But yeah.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just curious. Were you a scaredy cat? I mean, not so much with the horror movies, but in your life, like of the dark and stuff. Because I think a lot of people I meet who are really into horror were actually that kind of kid who was actually scared of something under their bed, and I almost coped. Horror films almost helped in the long run.
I think that was the case for me. I didn't. It's horror films seem to be throwing gasoline onto that fire, you know, at the time. And then when until I was about 12 or something, right. Some switch happened and I had realized that I had been sort of stocking my imagination with all these awful images to the point where now I can kind of roll with them and have a familiarity with them and have this association. There was a while I was so deeply afraid to be, you know, at night and alone in my bed. And then at the turning point, I'm just purely passionate about horror. And instead of putting off seeing them, but having that morbid curiosity, I'd go towards them.
Yeah, it's funny. It's really interesting. It seems to be a real pattern. Yeah. I think that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Stephen King before. So did your love, when you were getting into these films in your teens, did your love extend outside of movies? And did you start reading stuff like Stephen King, Clive Barker, and just, you know, celebrating all kinds of horror stuff?
Yeah, I did. Although I'm not a terribly good reader. But Stephen King and Clive Barker, I pushed myself into several of their books. For the record, Candyman's one of my favorites as well. I mean,
definitely.
That was a real.
It's one of the highlights of the 90s. Like, we look at in decades.
Possibly the best of the 90s.
I think it's the best
horror 90s. Movie of the
Certainly
90s.
The classiest, that's for sure. I mean, so well made.
Yeah. Really classy. And that was and that was a short story. I went and sought out of his. But yeah, we're talking about Clive Barker. I mean, Nightbreed was, which I guess is probably late 80s, right? But.
1990. Well, the book, maybe, probably, but the movie.
Yeah. Right, that's another one that had that perfect mesh of scary stuff. Cronenberg is terrifying in that, but it's it sort of aligned the viewer with the monster in a way that was empowering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like. You know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, where, you know, the kids get the powers and they get to fight back and stuff. There's something kind of cool about the vagueness of what is monster, what is man, what is hero, what is villain.
Right, right. I think what's interesting about Nightbreed is that it kind of did something in horror that you hadn't seen in a while, which was what you were talking about, which is align yourself with a monster, which kind of fell in line with the latter days of the Universal Classic movie monsters. Because you started out watching them going, oh, I'm terrified of the Frankenstein monster. Oh, my God, Wolfman is vicious. Oh, my God, and the Invisible Man is a terrorist.
Right.
And then as the movies went on, you were like, I identify with those guys. I know what the Frankenstein monster is about, except – with Nightbreed, it did it in a post-80s kind of prism, which was hardcore horror. Like, you had Shuna Sassy, who's, like, completely naked but porcupine, quills. And you
still
had...
Hot.
Yeah.
Still hot, right.
It just did it very well in that regard.
Really
well. Yeah.
And, that was also the era of the supernatural killer franchise, which all those movies kind of started... You know, felt like, you know, our protagonist is Nancy or whatever. But as the sequels started coming out and the heroes became expendable, the, you know, Freddy becomes funnier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he becomes, people start going out to see Nightmare on Elm Street because we relate to Freddy. And there's mm-hmm. a sort of like guilty pleasure of, it's the stalker thing. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. we're seeing through the stalker's eyes.
Even Jason kind of progressed to funny at one point when yeah. he's like picking up campers in their sleeping bags and just hurling them. I remember there's a girl who gets killed with a party horn at one point. Like, yeah. it gets almost absurd.
Well, Manhattan, I
guess.
Yeah, he goes to New York.
You're wearing a New York hat, so Yankees.
Kicking the boombox is like cognizant yeah. Jason being a straight-up dick.
Of course, he's on a boat for 90% of the movie. Yeah. It's a long ride to Manhattan.
So which of the franchise guys, were the horror icons, stood out to you the most? Was it Freddy, Jason, Michael Myers, like, or did you love them all?
Definitely Freddy, just, you know, from youth, Freddy had something, it was such a completely, it was a boogeyman that had just no regard for taste in a way that I thought was just really, something very disturbing about, you know, the Wes Craven's mentality behind that, that character that just seeped into it. As far as just pure chilling, I mean, Chucky just killed it, right? I mean, that was such.
He's also funny and gets funnier.
Also funny, yeah. gets funnier. Gets funnier yeah. All, you know, I tend to be much more into the earlier years with these guys. Yeah. You know, like most of us. Right.
Well, the first Nightmare, people forget it's a scary movie.
It's a scary
when
movie.
When we were young, it scared the piss out of most of us. So
yeah,
and holds up.
Yeah, yeah, and
holds up. Immensely holds up.
Well, Wes Craven, every 10 years, he reinvented the genre with something really fucked up,
That's
like an
right.
idea that was just fucked up.
Yeah.
And then he would slowly, you know, it wasn't even the franchise. When he came back to his new Nightmare, did you see that in theaters?
Yes,
when it came out?
Which was kind of like his first stab at the Scream concept, mm-hmm. right?
Definitely self-referential Completely. Horror. Yeah,
but that one scared me. New Nightmare when it came out,
the idea
that
was still really strong. Yeah, it's just you know. First half, I think, was really strong.
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. Periphery characters, though. I mean, like, you've got, like, Pinhead. Pinhead is always on the periphery. Leatherface is always, I always feel like he's on the periphery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I definitely go Michael Myers all the way. If you have to pick one, he's the king, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think
brain scan, you know,
brain scan. Brain scan.
Was there any horror? I think we all had it when we were young, but like that you couldn't pick up. Like, was there any VHS covers where you're like either too worried about what was behind it? Because for me, it was the, like, you know, necromantic shit like that. Or there was those boxes that the Gene Roland Film Company. What's that company called? Who puts
Redemption?
Out Redemption. So it has this logo that just scared the shit out of me.
It forms a
I couldn't
mirror.
Even touch those. They're black and white weird woman with no top.
You were scared by that?
It just freaked me out.
Oh, like, why are you scared?
Just buy.
Scared of the Redemption logo. It's going to be a documentary.
Yeah, there's logo fear. But I mean, were there any horror that you were like, oh, that's not my bag? Or even like how we had a torture porn phase. Mm-hmm. Was there a kind of horror that just turned you off?
I think probably the stalker genre did at first. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like any first. I don't like anything kind of. Rapey or anything like that, or you know, the late 70s kind of got into like the true shock, very real grounded shit. You know, I would say that
he's wearing a spit on your grave T-shirt. People, you can't see. He's a total fraud.
Right, I'm a total fraud. No, I was much more into Lady in White.
Just
came out on Blu-ray, or is about
to come out. To come out on Blu-ray. Yeah,
that to me was one of the greats, and. You know, I think like a lot of these things that we're talking about, it was an easy in to relate to it because you had this the kid protagonist and that vulnerability, the same kind of thing you get with, you know, Danny Torrance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's like more supernatural.
I was more into the supernatural. Yeah. I still am.
And that was a rich decade for it. So.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Did your mom ever find out?
Yeah, I mean, she really
does now.
She knows now. She had the you know, the task of having to get me to go to sleep. So it would be, you know, that sort of tug of war. Did you watch some scary movie? No, you know, no, I didn't. She was also very, she was kind of instrumental as well in. My love of horror. She's the one that had the Stephen King books.
Oh, okay.
She had she has this real amazing sense of humor. And, you know, I think early on, you know, she had this thing that she would do to me where she'd go, you know, I was goofing off or something or certain, needed some sort of little discipline or something. And she'd go, go say something to my mom, and she goes, "Mommy's not here." She'd just go into like this weird.
That's your creepy Stepford. What is it? The Save a Child Cancer one you did.
Yeah.
Miriam.
I want to pee on a dying man.
That's
the exact voice. I can do it. But she had this little game where. You know, she could sort of, no siblings, single mom. So she could really freak me out. Yeah. You know, I'm like, "Stop, Mom. Don't do it.
Mother's not here.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, wow.
And so, and I'd have this giggle, this nervous laughter, but I'd still get, fruck out or whatever. And, I definitely have observed this really tight connection between comedy and horror. Mm. I think part of the reason, I wanted to make this horror movie I made with Blumhouse is because I felt like, I'd finally gotten all the comedic pedigree into shape, and I could sort of apply so many of these rules to the thriller genre, but at the same time do a movie that was firmly grounded in thriller. Mm-hmm. And, you just find that so much of it, both genres, is grounding absurdity. Mm-hmm. I always feel like in comedy and in horror, the more real the world is that your absurd notion is, the scarier it is. Jacob's Ladder is
Great one. Yeah. Yeah, it's all tension release, right? Both comedy.
It's funny that you mentioned it, because I always tell people that my two favorite genres, I grew up on horror and I grew up on comedies, in particular 80s comedies. Yeah. And the reason when I justify them both, I'm like, they're the only two genres that I know of that can instigate a immediate reaction out of your audience. Mm-hmm. You can't help but be jump and get scared. Right. And sometimes you can't help but laugh out loud when you see something. That's so right. I love that correlation. When did you start seeing that? Maybe we could touch also on horror comedies, if that works, because that's always the toughest sell.
Yeah.
But then you look at something like An American Werewolf in London, you're like, but that's perfect. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting because I was talking to a long time ago when I think it was around Land of the Dead when that came out and George Romero was doing his press tour. I had interviewed him about we were just doing the general kind of talking about horror. And he goes, "You know what?" He goes, "Everybody fucking thinks they can make a horror movie. Everybody." And he goes, "Everybody thinks they can make a comedy, but they can't." Mm-hmm. He goes, "I would never try a comedy, but I know horror." He goes, "But I feel like," he felt like, "the two biggest genres that people feel like they can automatically do because they could point to it and go, 'Oh, I could do that,' it's horror and comedy." Yeah. But mm-hmm. it's
the hardest.
But it's a ballet. It's a completely mm-hmm. and to merge those two, it's like it's a delicate balance.
And you can't bullshit them because without talking to your audience if it was good. Because right. they reacted.
Yeah.
You don't even need scorecards. You can kind of see it. They're, unlike a drama, Oscar bait kind of thing.
If you don't hear anything, you're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And I think you're right that comedy horror, the hybrid, seems to be one of the trickiest mm-hmm. things to do. Mm-hmm. It's been pulled off so few times well. And
what's the pinnacle of horror comedy? Which one's for you?
Well, first I'll just say, I think the secret is in that grounding thing.
Yeah.
And both the genres, they sort of unground each other if you allow them to. So in other words, the moment, if you're doing a horror, you want a horror comedy to be both scary legitimately mm-hmm. and funny legitimately. Yeah. Not be funny but not scary or vice right. versa.
He's heading towards Chopping Mall.
He's
teasing us into it.
So we're going to get to the chopping ball.
He's getting there.
But the the problem is, you do a bit, you just tell a joke or something, and that sort of ungrounds the reality of the horror, or vice versa. I think it's very hard to sort of maintain this very real thing.
Or they pitch the drama as funny drama, like Up. It's higher,
right.
bigger performances, and then you're not grounded.
You're not grounded. Right. You might not get the laugh or the scare.
Right.
So I think when it's done right, every time it's done right, it's a very specific mixture. It's a very specific alchemy.
Yeah.
I cite Ghostbusters as a great one.
Yeah.
Even though it's leaning on comedy, certainly as a kid, the scary scenes are legit and they're great.
Gosh. That librarian messed me up. That was one that I saw.
Librarian, the hands in the chair, the devil dogs. it's all good stuff. And I think the bedrock that's grounding both the comedy and the horror is it feels real. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, especially on the comedic level in that movie, it's not the whole joke is that it's normal guys. Like it's guys who are kind of plumbers and eating Chinese food and
just getting by.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, sort of saying, all right, what if you took Exorcist and applied it to the big city? Well, they'd be kind of like exterminators. So it had this foundation of like very, you know, what applying reality to these two extreme things. Right. And that was just it's a perfect movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think you have I always view that as comedy horror. I know this is stupid, but I see that. Oh, it's a comedy horror versus a horror comedy.
Yeah.
I think of Evil Dead 2 as a horror comedy,
mm-hmm.
Reanimated horror comedy. Yeah. But yeah. These bigger movies that are – it's a comedy first with horror elements.
You know? Right. So what's Burbs for you?
Definitely comedy horror.
Okay.
Right.
But I love you. It's perfect is what it
right.
is to me.
Yeah.
It's a perfect movie.
I think who the characters are, who the protagonist is probably big. You know, about that. It's like if you have a funny lead, it's kind of the comedy horror.
Yeah.
Right. Scream is one of the great
horror comedies. Yeah.
A horror comedy and there's very few that I've seen that have danced on both of those in that way, which is why I love if I was to do a horror comedy, I would probably lean towards the horror part.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, first of all, that the comedy is becoming more and more second nature, more my bread and butter. So the horror part, it's like that to me is the part that can really get unhinged with the wrong style of joke or mm-hmm. bit. You know,
did you see what did you think about Cabin in the Woods? That's the last one I remember that truly had both.
Because
it
before
felt
that
funny
was like,
and scary.
It was like Jennifer's Body before that and Cabin in the Woods, and both were kind of, I mean, the Cabin in the Woods did okay.
It's
but
funny
not...
with them, people we know, everyone's like loves
but
it, but
then
you go,
it.
Yeah,
the audience
can
go to it.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah, it was that was a complex one for me because I'm such a fan of this genre and what we're talking about. Yeah. And there was something, Cabin in the Woods, it had kind of like this Gremlins 2 like release of like, all right, let's just go for it, you know, balls
meta.
To the wall.
Yeah.
Let's be meta. Let's give them everything. And I would have really loved it when I was a kid. I think ultimately my problem with Cabin in the Woods is it didn't really chill me.
Right.
But I have so much love and respect for that project they did it. You know,
I think that's the overarching kind of feeling from horror fans is like it didn't scare them. You know,
it wasn't because Scream had the
mastery of Wes Craven to guide you through the kind of orchestrated chase sequences and the kills.
Right.
Cabin in the Woods just felt like it was all idea.
But I think that horror fans still love Cabin in the Woods because it was winking at them
the whole time.
Yeah. It was referential. And referential doesn't scare.
Right.
Yeah, almost ever. I can't really think of a film that uses references to the genre and can still get you, you know?
Yeah, it was rooted in the genre, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the story itself, it was like, it was almost a parody of the genre.
Yeah.
And so it didn't have that base of feeling real that I think could have served it a little bit more.
What
but
do you know
who,
about
who
parody? Just calm down. Yeah. Come on.
Well, I was gonna say, do you feel like horror fans don't like being made fun of? Like when you kind of like feel like you're kind of talking to them, like they're being talked down to. I always kind of feel like when a movie does that and makes the horror fan feel small, like they completely reject the movie. Like, fuck this movie, you know?
Like, you mean like when you're watching a movie, like I don't know, like. Something like
maybe Scary Movie. Like I feel like
that's
something
comedy?
That's like way over the top. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because I'll watch it and I'll be, you know, I'm like, guys, this is not landing. Although every once in a while, get something.
Gag,
yeah, there'll be a gag that works. But I feel like maybe Cabin in the Woods sometimes divides people because they feel like they're being talked down to. But at the same time, my argument also is. Guys, they're going so deep cut into this.
That's the difference, right?
That you shouldn't be mad about it, you know? It's weird. It's a weird dichotomy, you know?
There's an element of that movie where it does feel like it's kind of for horror fans in that I think horror fans get it immediately instantly.
Yeah.
But it is kind of structured for somebody maybe not a horror fan to still get it.
Yeah.
So it has a little bit of... As a horror fan, I think it's you want to feel like you're ahead of it, or you are ahead of it, maybe a little bit more. But
all right, I want to talk about Jennifer's Body for a second. What are your thoughts on Jennifer?
I never saw Jennifer's
You never
body.
Saw it?
Right, we're gonna take a quick commercial break. For 96 minutes.
Have you guys done a lot of Jennifer's Body?
No, he's done a lot of Jennifer's Body.
Okay. Oh. What?
Cheers. Did you see? I'm just curious because I remember seeing it so viscerally. Blair Witch in theaters. Did you see it when it hit? What'd you think?
I did. I loved it.
First found footage? Had you seen a found footage before that?
No. I guess I hadn't. I mean, there's the elements in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
But
I think most people remember Blair Witch. I didn't know anything, man. I thought it was real. Yeah. I wasn't quite there. I had a couple.
Your kid, that's my favorite part. My favorite joke in Keanu. I thought it was real.
Everybody went to the same screening of Usual Suspects. Sixth Sense, right?
Yeah.
I loved Blair Witch, and I loved Paranormal Activity. I mean, I think those are two of my all-time favorites, and it's because of what we're talking about. It's like nothing is more sacred in those movies than the reality part.
Mm-hmm.
So when it gets to the scares, all they have to do is tweak a little bit, blow somebody's hair, set up some sticks, and your imagination goes crazy. But it's because you're allowed to feel like, oh my God, this could be me and my friends. This could be what the hell is going on. Loved it. Yeah, 100%.
We'll want to see the new one coming out.
Yeah, we're
probably soon.
We're hoping to.
Yeah, two weeks or
whatever. Yeah.
The paranormal films, even the sequels, kind of creep me out. Even if they're bad and you watch them alone, there's something about them that just – because it's – just feels like security cameras or something, you know?
Yeah. Meanwhile, here at the House of Blum, the walls are starting to bleed on top of Elric.
Right.
Shut him up.
They forced me to say that.
But the pace of that movie, I remember seeing that one in the theater, and it's such a masterclass in how little you have to do to scare the bejesus out of the entire crowd. And my favorite part of that movie is, probably about two-thirds of the way through it. There's that – I think it's after the advisor comes and goes, oh, no, this is a demon. Which is also, first of all, my second favorite part of the movie because it's like, okay, the intentions of this thing become clearer, which are not good. And that just throws this whole thing. But there's a moment where we go back to the camera in front of the bed, and we've been there probably six times already. And this is the one where the shit hits the fan, right? We all know. But I remember in the audience, the moment it comes up, just from where we are in the movie, the entire audience had this, we've been watching this, silently the whole time, but the audience knew. This is the one. They've strung us along, and now something's going to happen. I don't want to be a part of this. And I just thought that was so powerful by introducing this same device that you've already set up and we've already sat through, that all of a sudden there's this huge reaction to it.
Yeah.
That was
like a joke.
Like a good joke.
Well, it's funny. On that note, with Paranormal Activity, Blair Witch, and even when we mentioned Scream before, the theatrical experience is still very important to all of us. But do you remember which movies stand out to you like that? Like, what were some of the best horror theatrical experiences? Wait, you'll never forget it because of how it played with an audience.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably, Paranormal was probably my all-time, craziest experience in a theater with an audience, with a horror audience. I mean, other than that... it's interesting because the audiences tend to lock into the cheaper ones more, or the type of audience that goes to a cheaper sort of movie is sort of gets into it more. And I guess I don't know what I mean when I say cheaper. I mean something a little bit
easier
more
scares.
It's
the black cat jumping out on a car.
Sure.
There was one movie I saw. I was like, I think it was like 2002, 2003. I'm not going to name the movie.
Why not?
It's called Darkness Falls.
There you go.
And literally a black cat jumped out on the hood of the car. And I was like, are you kidding? kidding me? In 2002, 2004, whatever it is.
There was one, and I can't even remember it. It had like a younger female protagonist. Like it was a remake too, like When a Stranger Calls or something like that that came out. And yeah, and it was repeatedly like the cat. I was like, why are you even putting up with this cat? Just put it outside. It keeps coming up.
On YouTube, there's cat scare montages. Yeah. You can watch all of
them. I love the horror supercuts. I love all those online. It's like the mirror gag, you know? Yeah. It's like you close the medicine chest mirror and it's like, you know? Or the ones that don't happen, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So silly.
The other thing about the audience, you know, it's another link to comedy in that they really are the best way to watch both is with an audience.
Sure.
And the laugh on comedy, the fear in a horror is sort of becomes exponential, becomes communal. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really loved about The Cabin in the Woods sort of statement they're saying about what horror movies are for us, that it's somehow purging this
ritualistic thing.
Yeah. And that's really how I feel about both genres, is that these are the ways that we as people deal with our fears and our troubles and the worst things in life. Sometimes it's to laugh, sometimes it's to put ourselves through that in a not real way, but to experience that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, often it's both. You know, I love a really good horror movie. It's like the scare turns into a laugh in the audience because the nerves are there.
And you're having a bad day and that person's being ripped apart. You're like, hey, it's not that bad. That's right. I call it perspective.
That's right. I'm curious about, you know, growing up for you, how horror kind of played into your upbringing in terms of kind of like – in terms of society, in terms of your friendship circles. Like, because I remember for me, you know, being a horror fan, you know, I carried around a VHS version of Evil Dead 2 in my backpack. And I was like, yo, you guys got to see this movie. Check this out. And then everybody would be like, you're really fucked up. Or Dead Alive. When Dead Alive, Alive came out, like I rented the Laserdisc, taped it to put it on VHS, and then I spread it around. But that did not make me any more popular, and I wanted to so bad
for that.
You know, I mean, having Fangoria in my Trapper Keeper was not hiding it.
But for you, I mean, like, was it overt or was it kind of something? I mean, like, horror was always part of the kind of counterculture, you know, and you were the misfit, you know.
It sort of became that in high school. I sort of wore it as a badge of honor.
Yeah,
I think what people, you know, horror fans, one of the things we love about horror is that there are people who can't take it.
Yeah.
Right? There's a sort of – there's a pride when you talk to someone who's like, no, I can't watch horror movies.
Yeah.
I can't.
Maybe it starts with your parents, right? It's like a screw you to your parents.
That's right. Yeah. And there's something very empowering about sort of feeling like, oh, wow, I'm mastering fear in a way that other people can't handle. And I think it does, it was very huge for me, very, very much proud, you know, when I could accept horror movies and go for it in my,
great soundbite for the article. He has mastered horror.
I've mastered horror.
So you can write that as the heading. He's now a master of horror.
Well, you know, for me, the mastering of horror was to be able to watch it without pissing my pants at night. That was it. It was just
still working on that.
I by no means mastered horror, but I love the identity of being able to handle it, like I said, up through 12 years old, I really, really couldn't.
Is there any truth to that skit? I think one of the funniest things you guys did was the one where you walk out of a horror movie and you're like, man, that was a stupid movie. Where'd you park? Over there. Where'd you park? Over there? And the two guys have to like walk together to their car because deep down they're terrified. Was it? Did you have experiences like that with a friend? Because to me that's a classic.
Well, you know, that's really about, you know, I grew up in, you know, Upper West Side, Manhattan, would go to Lowe's 84th for my horror movies, which was at that point, you know, pretty much kind of like it was the blacker of the two theaters you could go to on the Upper West Side. And, you know, the African-American horror movie audience is such a wonderful audience to watch thrillers with, because they're more demonstrative. We yell at the movies, and it's everything that everybody wants to do at the movie. But there's a feeling of this event. And so I always just loved that you know, a lot of the African American audience members that would see I would see horror with, you know, would have like, you know, this idea of like, nah, you ain't gonna scare me, you ain't gonna scare me, you ain't gonna get me. You know, it's like, it's not real. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's stupid. But the more stupid that they were calling something, the more you know. You know, you can just watch people just freak out, jump on their chair. Nah, I ain't get me.
I saw 28 Days Later deep in Brooklyn, and it was just like a random was visiting there, and it was like opening night or whatever, and it was the loudest audience I've ever seen. And I just remember this one woman, she just kept saying every time you'd shower, you know, if I see your dick one more motherfucking time, every time. But it was like a totally different experience.
Oh, that's
it wasn't
great.
Watching a movie in the same way. It's not. Yeah. It's no longer. It really is more like a live show.
Well, it's a, right, it's a testament. It's a testament to the theatrical experience, yeah, which is, yeah, waning. I mean, like the greatest. I mean, like I saw many movies in Jersey City where I was going to college. You know, in New York, you know, it was like Bride of Chucky, Halloween, H2O, good movies. Elevated theatrically, great movie.
Yeah. Great, you know?
And then
great
coming
movie
out here, seeing Exorcist, the director's cut at the Man's Chinese Theater, mm-hmm, that was an event. Yeah. That was right. Like, you know, people really got into it. You know, they slipped in that new spider walk sequence and people lost their fucking minds, right, you know? Right,
right, you know what movie I saw recently that people actually, like I saw it in North Hollywood near my house, but The Visit. I wasn't expecting for people to be like screaming and going, "Oh no, run from that!" And they were.
Yeah, that's
and
actually, it was I had that like, same experience.
It was a
yeah,
very
good
reactionary
yeah
film.
I thought that was an amazing movie. I thought that was had some of the scariest sequences. Yeah.
Her under the floor.
That's when people were actually like yelling at the screen
and her picking up the camera like,
"Yeah, yeah." When she's under.
Who made that? Which company made that film?
Yeah.
And now a plug for Blumhouse.com.
The scene with the end with the diaper too.
Not the end.
No, that's not blowing anything. That's not blowing
Becca
endings. Oh, come on. That doesn't blow anything. Diaper.
It's just only going to send people to order that movie.
Yeah.
Diaper.
Now go get that. But yeah, that's another place where people were like screaming. And it was awesome.
Yeah, I think M. Night is real, is truly a modern master of fear. His scares haunt my shit. Mm. No pun intended.
I see a whole skit coming from that.
Someone
we did have a sketch we never did, actually, that we wrote in, I think, the first or second season. It kept hanging around, but it was – I was trying to be M. Night's assistant.
Oh, my
Keegan
gosh
was playing M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh, man.
And wow. I think the whole – God, I don't remember. Somehow – He was in the interview. He was keeping me on my toes, and he was conducting the interview like one of his movies,
right,
all the way to the twist. And everything. Anyway,
nice.
I'm a huge fan of his, actually.
Yeah.
And you know, I know there's been all, you know, there's, you know, feelings all over the board on him. I feel like you know, he's, you know, say what you will about
him.
He made
some big movies.
Look, I mean, like, no. Look, I mean, like, everybody's had their ups and downs, you know? It's like all the big guns, even from the 70s. And it's like De Palma and Craven.
That De Palma documentary, it's meant one hit to a failure.
Friedkin, you know, it's like, let's not forget, Wayne Friedkin made The Guardian.
I love The Guardian. Oh, shit.
And, no.
Everyone
now,
has
now
a ghost of Mars, guys. It happens.
Everyone has a ghost of Mars.
Oh,
back up.
But you know, I do love that. All one thing you can expect when you're watching one of his movies is that you can't really know what to expect. He does his thing, and I appreciate somebody who's making films. You know, love them or hate them, that are unique and in his own style and genre.
Sure.
And I feel like he and De Palma, you know, although people will call me heretic for this, but they're two guys who at least attempted to pick up that Hitchcock mantle.
Yeah, yeah.
The biggest De Palma fan in the world is like sitting right there.
I mean, so. I'm a fan, but I mean, but he did you see the documentary on
I did.
It's just great how candid he is about when it doesn't work and people hating his work. Like, I remember, I got to remember, one of the first movies I remember going, oh my God, what the fuck? This is such a movie, was Snake Eyes. I remember when I saw Snake Eyes in a theater, I was like, Jesus, man. Like, this is.
There's a fucking title.
I know
this
is a movie. are lost in the movie. You're always knowing you're watching a movie.
Yeah.
And so with De Palma, sometimes that just doesn't work, and then sometimes he hits it, you know? Yeah. And it's a weird, but I love just how open he was to discuss it. It's a great
yeah
play.
Blowout is
oh yeah Blowout
is the one right yeah. I mean that's like
and Dress to Kill. I think Dress to Kill is
and Dress
freaking
to Kill
great.
Yeah,
you know, that's the thing. I always say this about some of the horror guys too, but it's like when you look at a filmography from a director, it's like it's so hard to get one classic, mm-hmm. one that no one will ever forget that changes yeah. things. So it's like, you know, John Carpenter, no matter what he makes, and I like a lot of his films, he made fucking Halloween. Yeah. You know, Wes Craven did it three times. He did.
But Carpenter had a run of maybe six in a row that are
oh, they were great. Yeah. But, you know, like with M. Night, you know, obviously he made The Sixth Sense, which is a great movie, and Unbreakable is my favorite of his movies. And it's like he made it. So, like, no matter what he makes from here on out, you could hate it, you can like it. He's done at least one or two mm-hmm. that are, like, you know, kind of classic.
I'm so. Pretty psyched to see the one he's got coming up, Slay. Mm-hmm. Or,
I know, it looks pretty crazy.
Split.
Thank you.
Slay's another one.
Who produced that? Who produced that movie?
That would be...
Oh, my God.
We need you because you don't work for this company at all.
Yeah, so you can say it.
You say shit.
I love all of them. I even loved Ghost Dimension by Blumhouse.com. It was my favorite of the Paranormal Activity films.
Blumhouse.com had nothing to do with this.
Is there somebody behind you?
But I was going to say, it's not, in terms of, like, you know, directing classics, it's not a fucking race. It's just like, right. what kind of movies are you putting out into the world that say, this is me? Like, Craven to the very end, you know? Right. You know, what was the... Brian Collins' favorite
My Soul
movie, My Soul to Take, you know, even to the bitter end. Man,
originally 25.8.
Like, yeah. He's still, you know, he was still injecting a little bit of that Craven flavor in there, you know. Yeah. He wrote it. He wrote the movie, you know. So it's
still Fang time. It's cool.
Oh, God. Nice.
But I remember, talking to Nick, remember he did this, Wes produced his last one. Nick was saying Wes had like 10 things he was trying to get made up until the last couple weeks. Yeah, you know, it's just, you're all over the place.
Well, you're focused on where you are in your life at that moment, right. creatively, right. you know. You know, I'm just curious because, you know, obviously Elric's brought up a few of your skits and stuff, but, I tend to love when you kind of touch on horror stuff. You know, I mean, the Gremlins 2 thing is one of the funniest things I've seen. So, I mean, you know, you guys are – if you can talk a little bit about the creative process, because when you're doing a show, you're trying to come up with X amount of skits and stuff like that. So how much does your personal tastes kind of flow into what you're working on? I mean, I guess it has to be a big portion of it.
Yeah, it's huge. I think with anything, any type of art, comedy, horror, or anything else, I think one thing that I've, from doing improv, which is kind of my pedigree from like 19 to 23, you sort of learn that if it's personal, then it works mm-hmm. for whatever reason. So when we were doing Key and Peele, the idea was let's make a show that only Keegan and I can perform. That we could write and perform. We did have writers, mm-hmm. but that's kind of like a perfect, you know, screening method. It's like if it doesn't come through our voices and it doesn't have something that, you know, if you could give the sketch to an SNL or another sketch show and they could pull it off and it could be equally good, it wasn't for us. And that was kind of that was kind of the rule. And it is similar to this movie I just did here. It's a very it's a point of view film. It's very much, you know, it's funneled through my experiences to an extent. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my, you know, especially when breaking into a new genre or breaking into a show. It's like you have to, all you can start with is your expression. Mm-hmm. And I think what a lot of artists get tripped up by is, you know, I mean, we're artists, so we all kind of we hate our expression, we hate ourselves, we hate what we're putting out, we're tired of what we're working on 5 minutes into starting, and no, it's got to be better. But what you find in improv a lot is things that aren't necessarily funny to you hit with an audience. Mm-hmm. Specifics, you know, there's this improv game where you somebody does a monologue, improvises a monologue, and everyone improvises based on it. I was always afraid to do this game because it's like you want the monologues to be funny and whatnot. Time after time again, if you try to make this monologue funny, it's you get nothing. If you just tell a story from your life that's real, people laugh and mm-hmm. they find the moments of truth, they find the specifics. So that's kind of been my MO so far.
So where does racist zombie come from?
So racist zombie.
Yeah, is that your critique on Walking Dead and what was happening? Every black character was getting killed off, or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, it was actually.
Was it really
original? Yeah, it was originally a response to that very notion, but it was that sketch was written by this guy Rich Tallarico, who's a brilliant guy from the Second City. And you know, he put together this, you know, amazing concept. We latched onto it very quickly. And basically, what happens with the process is someone will, you know, come up with the sketch idea. We'll kind of riff it out, and the ones that feel right and feel like they're a Key and Peele sketch, we'll all, you know, we'll dogpile on, I'll tell jokes, and then ultimately, you know, usually I or one of the other EPs will sort of, you know, strip it down to what it needs to be. But we definitely overwrite, overshare with each other, and throw a lot out.
I like that. Like, I mean, my favorite one is I made a joke when you sat down about continental breakfast. But what I loved about it is it starts as this like really bizarre, almost Forrest Gump type character who goes into a hotel and he's just like, oh, you get a free continental breakfast. Ooh. You get really taken with this idea. And then it becomes a Shining tribute. Yeah. And by the end, we are in the Shining. And, and you're crying. And I'm just like, this is one of the great, it was like one of the greatest short films I've ever seen.
Thank you. That's
character.
One of my favorites too. And I love, you know, there's a lot that we've done. We do sort of all kinds of different layers and styles. It's all about changing it up so you don't know what to expect. Some of it is kind of heady and sort of smart. That was a nice sort of stupid sketch in a way. And not stupid like it was easy to come up with, but just, you know, we all relate to the idea of like continental sounds lofty. Sounds so, you know, amazing, and then what it actually is. And then that's just
he picks up the Danish. He's talking about each country, each food. Right. It's the yogurt. It's Greece. He picks up the Danish. And what do you say? You say Finland or Belgium? No, you say
something like that.
And it's just
Belgium.
Great because you do,
that's just the tramp.
Yeah.
Character, right? The archetype. It's the guy, you know, it's like Bugs Bunny, Charlie Chaplin.
Right.
You know, they have no class, right? Bugs Bunny lives in a hole, but he's like, this is the life. You know, he's
right.
You know, Charlie Chaplin's he's a homeless dude who like, you know, dusts off an apple off the garbage and eats it like he's the King of England.
Yeah, somehow cures some girl's blindness. I've never worked out how he got the money at City Lights, but it works.
That's right. So there's something really universal about that archetype that anytime it's used, it's like we all want to think we're better than we are at some point.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
How often do you keep up on modern horror and stuff like that? Like, obviously, I just saw Don't Breathe, which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you keep up on what's going on horror-wise?
Not as well as I would like. I haven't seen Don't Breathe yet. And in fact, I haven't seen a couple of these big ones that have come out this year. Mm. Mostly because I'm working on my other, you know, the other one. But, you know, I definitely don't see anything that isn't considered the top-notch cream of the crop anymore.
Mm.
So, which I kind of, you know, I sort of envy horror fans that'll just give it to me. I'll watch it all, whatever.
Right.
But we all kind of outgrow that to an extent because of commitments and getting older
life.
And time. I talked about it curmudgeonly. I sound curmudgeonly, but they do a little less for you, a little less. Right. There's a shrinking love, you know.
Yeah.
But when they're great, I don't know if you see the movie The Witch when you get a chance.
Yeah, I saw The
Those
Witch.
Kind of things, whether they're great, like whether it's – some people didn't like The Witch, obviously, but it's still going for that thing.
Yes.
You know, it's going for that throwback to things in the 70s where it felt, like you said, grounded.
Yeah.
It's grounded in historical realism, and it's scary. You know,
yeah,
I was going to say, sorry, horror just rolls with your age. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like it's, you know, as I'm entering into my 40s, my tastes are so – someone told me when my 20s, they were like – he was a writer that I knew very well, and he was like, Ryan, when you get older – you're just gonna stop giving a shit. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you've got a fire in you for horror. You really love this gore, but you know what? You're gonna start hating gore movies. And I'm like, no, I'm never gonna start hating gore movies. And then now I'm just kind of like, no, I want more. I want sophistication, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like it just kind of changes with your age a little bit.
Yeah, you know? Totally. I can still sit through a movie if it has one new great scare.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
Yeah.
You know, you know, that doesn't happen too often. I did love The Witch for that reason you're talking about. It felt like it really, you know, we hear about so many witches, you know, through, you know, growing up, and there's all sorts in pop culture. This one felt like they were saying, like, you know all the witches you heard about? Fuck that. This is what a real witch looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, though it didn't scare me that much,
yeah.
I just loved the beauty of it. I loved that it felt like the first time you're watching something real that is a witch.
Yeah.
And so,
and it's pretty taboo early up, you know, with the babies and stuff.
Yeah, and it goes.
That's a pretty good way to get you
pre-baby baby's blood bath. She's pretty gnarly, but afterwards, you know, you just need baby's blood bath, and she's pretty hot.
Yeah. Is there a director whose work you follow, you know, old or new, who you're just like an auteuristic kind of? Oh, I like David Lynch movies or Cronenberg, or is somebody who's you always will watch a new film from?
I mean, really, those guys.
nailed it.
Although, you know, although actually, I haven't seen Cronenberg's last few. So hear mixed things about.
You're okay.
But I love
very talky.
Okay, yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But I do love him. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say, yeah, my answers to that probably aren't going to be too fun. I love obviously old school Spielberg. when Spielberg does horror, it's the greatest movies of all time for me. And you know, I know it's controversial, but M. Night is the guy out there right now that I just have this. It's a guilty pleasure because I feel like I get out. You know, there's a lot of haters out there, but he's somebody I know I'm going to get a certain quality. I know I'm going to get something new. And the visual quality, the visual storytelling quality, and he's not going to get a movie by me.
I never watched the one where he's the big fantasy thing. That was the one where
Lady in the Water,
Airbender,
right?
Yeah, that
right.
was Airbender. The one where. But that's probably him just making a big non-personal.
Well, that was
thing, right?
Yeah. I was going to say that's somebody else's IP.
Yeah, yeah.
So it
yeah.
feels like there's already a disconnect immediately.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure I never saw it either, but I'm sure that showed through the work. You know, because he was just like he probably found some. What was it? What did he do before that? Lady in the Water. So
yeah,
it's probably
Water.
Like a one
or
for them
the
kind
village.
Of deal.
Uh huh. Yeah.
All right. So I want to hear your top five. Top five horror.
Whoa. All right.
Dropping it.
So it goes like that.
Yeah.
Probably it'll probably be fairly boring in the end because
we want to know.
We'll agree.
Yeah, yeah.
So The Shining.
Okay.
Paranormal.
Okay.
I'll say the Sixth Sense.
Nice. All right.
I will say Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And
number one.
Oh, number I was.
Well,
they
were in Randon order. Randon.
Yeah, okay,
we'll take Shining at number one.
Let's. I'm gonna say The Birds.
Oh, nice. Oh, I like it.
Because you know that I love anybody who can sort of. I love the B movie concept done in an elevated way,
right,
and
right.
that's like the master of all of them. You know, for me, it's.
Keep talking about the word grounded has come up a lot, and that's what that is. That's a B movie, but they take it in very. This is about a relationship, and it's about somebody's overbearing mother, and these are the events that happen in the background. You know,
that's
it's
right.
pretty cool.
Yeah. And if my memory is correct, I love the fact that it's not. Unless it is on some kind of report, but it's not explained what's going on.
No,
no, no, no.
Right?
And if
made today, they would explain.
They would.
And they would explain it.
Yeah. Or if it was called Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shut up.
They
yeah.
would explain it.
Still a master.
That last scene.
Oh, right. There was Psycho.
Well, the birds were driven crazy, but we don't have any of that. That's what's so great about it.
That's great. Know? Yeah. That's a good.
So no Texas Chainsaw. Do you remember? Did that fuck you up when you saw it? Did you see it later?
Yeah, it did. It did. And I think it's a great movie. I saw it. I only saw pieces of it as a kid.
Mm.
I've seen it more recently than a lot of classics. I think it scared me so much. The dirtiness, the grittiness.
Yeah.
That it sort of kept me away. It sort of kept in that.
It's pretty unsafe. That
it's
film.
A really
it was unsafe.
Film.
It feels dangerous,
which is great.
It's got this weird aesthetic to it that it doesn't look like anything kind of before or after
right.
it. Mm-hmm. It looks like newsreel footage.
Right.
And,
yeah, and every
it's
time they clean it up, I get scared that like, oh no, they're going
to
restore it and it's not going to look the same. And it's just as
and
powerful
just
every
powerful.
Time. Yeah,
it is. Yeah.
Do you get as a horror fan? Do you get into and because Halloween's right around the corner? Do you get into the Halloween spirit? Is this a time of year that you celebrate? Because This guy's already got his decorations up.
Mine are going up this weekend. I'm pretty psyched.
What do you do for the holiday?
I actually don't.
Really? No costumes? Nothing?
Well, with Key and Peele, we would do like costumes every day, like two or three costumes every day. So the last thing you want to do is like, you know, when you get home is put on a costume. So my past like five Halloweens have been me at home. Just hanging.
It's kind of like the Buffy the Vampire Slayer route. You know, on Buffy, the monsters took a break.
Yeah.
Like they were like, you know what? It's our holiday. We're just going to kick back into the crypt and hang out. Right. And Buffy was like, who do I slay? What's going on?
That's kind of my philosophy. It's like, hey, you know, it's Halloween is every other day of the year for me. And another genre I realized I've sort of stepped out of, but there was a while I was getting into the, you know, Japanese Korean movies.
Ooh.
Oh yeah,
and, speaking my language now.
Yeah, and I love
Suicide Club.
Yeah. Almost said Squad.
Yep. Yeah,
almost have it. That's one of my all time favorites. Right. Tale of Two Sisters.
Yep, great one
as well. Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. But I
Rob's so on this year. Tale, what's the Busan one?
Oh, Train to Busan.
Train to Busan is amazing. Yeah. It's awesome.
Do yourself a favor and check it out. Yeah. Because I was telling them on a previous podcast, you know, you go into a movie. It's a zombie movie, you know, zombies on a train. And you go in going, okay, what else you got? Like, what do you have that you're going to possibly show me in 2016 that I've never seen in zombie cinema or TV? And the third act, I was like, oh, you got that.
It's amazing.
Got
you.
It's really great.
It's absolutely amazing. Yeah.
That's great.
That was a really great one. And then the wailing we saw earlier this year, that's a little more avant-garde.
It's a art house, but it's intense and totally different. Yeah. It's not like anything
I recommend The Piper, which I saw at Fantasia. I really liked.
Okay.
Yeah. It's unusual, but you'll like it, Rob, because it's got a lot of
Yeah, I love the Korean stuff.
It goes like totally violent in the third act. You'll love it.
Korean stuff is great.
Yeah.
Phone? Was that one?
I've seen Phone.
That had the best.
I have not heard that title since I saw it. It's amazing.
That had the best performance from a young actor in any horror movie I've seen. Do you remember the little girl in that?
Yes.
I don't.
God, I don't either.
Yeah, that was one.
This was a Tartan Asian.
Tartan Asian was dropping like 10 a month.
Oh, yeah. I was all over
that.
That
kid was great.
She has a sequence in the last few moments of the movie where she does, you know, essentially like a possession type thing, and she just acts it. She must be four or five. She must be like five. And she puts everything into this thing, and I remember, watching that, I said, nope, that is that scene alone is the best child acting I've seen in a horror movie.
I'd already visit it.
Looking up phone. For remake
rights. Look that up. And the witch, the child acting in The Witch was absolutely incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And
the goat twins. Oh, yeah. The goat acting was
hard. Goat acting. You're halfway there. Greatest of all time.
We interviewed the father and the mother from The Witch for the Blumhouse website. And the things that Black Phillip did. Like, apparently he was just, like, a dick on set. Like, was just this horrible goat. Like, he gored people and was just, like, horrible to work
with.
He's goats
today.
He was such a diva actor.
Speaking of comedy, the dad from that was from the British Office.
Right?
Yeah. He's a great character. And in that, the witch's voice just kind of resonates.
He is so scary.
It's one of those
witch.
Incredible voices.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't remember him from The Office. So it was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You got your top five, and we talked
to top five. I'm gonna call in someday and be like, I have to change my top five.
It's okay. We change ours like every couple of months.
I gotta go more obscure and cool.
You're gonna be walking out with several recommendation lists.
Hey,
yes.
What's that on your shirt?
Visual gag that won't work.
I will tell you all. No, I will tell you. Last night I watched it, and it's the first time in a month where I've had tears running down my face. And of all the skits, that's the one that makes me laugh the most, and it's the most base and like totally, you know, like
that's
throw
what does
away.
It a lot of the time.
I was crying. And it had a Carrie reference.
And there's a Carrie reference.
Well, when Get Out hits theaters, we'll have you back on.
Tell us about the
nitty gritty of everything.
I can tell you the nitty gritty, and I'm very excited.
We can't wait to see it.
It's cool. It's cool you made a horror movie.
That's cool.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
See you guys next week.
All right. See you. Bye.